Well, thank you very much to the organizers for asking me to speak here. So this is all joint with Frank Caligari. So I want to begin by just talking about what modularity listing is. So if I go back to the beginning of the story, so if I let E over Q be a semi-stable elliptic curve, then, as I'm sure everyone here is aware, Taylor and Wiles, a series of two papers, proved that the elliptic curve was modular. A key step in their proof was a so-called modularity listing theorem, or an R equals T theorem, that was sort of the following form. It was an identification of a ring R with a Hecke algebra, so a Hecke algebra in weight 2 and level gamma naught of n, some n, the conductor of the elliptic curve, over Zp, localizes some the maximal ideal of this Hecke algebra corresponding to a Galois representation. So they proved an isomorphism like this, where R is a universal deformation ring of what? Well, the Galois representation rho bar, which is just the P torsion on this elliptic curve. And it, of course, not just an unrestricted deformation ring, let me just say here, of weight 2, level gamma naught of n, and probably determined and fixed to be the cyclotomic character. So it's called modularity listing because they were able to prove such results under some assumptions. In particular, for this R equals T theorem, they required that this residual representation rho bar be modular. And somehow, it's called modularity listing because we're listing the modularity of rho bar to any deformation to characteristic zero that's classified by this deformation ring R. So the idea is that the p-adic Tate module of this elliptic curve gives some deformation that's classified by R. Then by our isomorphism, it comes from some point of the Hecke algebra and hence a modular form. So this R equals T method has been generalized in many situations. So first of all, it was generalized to somehow to treat all elliptic curves over Q in a series of papers. It was generalized to sort of higher weights. So what do I mean by that? Well, isomorphisms to weight k Hecke algebras. generalized to GL2 over totally real fields. GSP4 over Q. and unitary groups. So at this point we're talking about n-dimensional representations satisfying some sort of duality. But in all of these generalizations there are of course some restrictions, and a particularly important one is that the Hodge-Tate weights of the underlying Galois representations have to be distinct. So for example here, for modular form of weight k, we know the Hodge-Tate weights are k minus 1 and 0, so if I want them to be distinct I need k to be at least 2. So the method fails in a number of situations. So first of all, when Hodge-Tate weights are not regular, so we have some sort of multiplicity in the Hodge-Tate weights. Of course, that's not the only situation where it fails. So maybe to give some examples, so GL2 over a number field K, where K is not totally real, or for example GLN over K, where N is bigger than or equal to 3, these are cases where their method just isn't going to work, and somehow sort of seems to be the case that the method fails when the automorphic representations you're looking for are not contributing to middle degree cohomology of some Shearmore variety. So it's sort of the exact cases where it's actually hard to construct Galois representations in the first place. So for example, it's well known that here constructing without some sort of duality assumption, conjugate self-duality, constructing Galois representations is hard. And even for weight 1 forms, which would be an example here, as Frank said, there's no really direct construction of the Galois representation in cohomology. It's constructed using congruences. So what I want to talk about is today is a sort of way to treat some of these cases where the Taylor-Wiles method does fail. And what I'll do is I'll sort of, later on in the talk, you can describe the extent to which the method is going to fail by associating some integer that I'll call a Taylor-Wiles defect to the Galois representation. And the Taylor-Wiles method will work when this defect is zero, and our method is going to be able to treat the case where the defect is one. So sort of the first case where the Taylor-Wiles method fails. So in particular, I'm going to prove a theorem about weight 1 forms, so let me say some things about those. So I think it was mentioned in Payman's talk the other day that R equals T theorems, I said here they fail for weight 1 forms, they do give you some information. So R equals T techniques in high weight combined with HEDA theory sort of give you an R equals T theorem over a HEDA family, so R tilde isomorphic to some HEDA Hecke algebra. And here this thing is going to be a sort of big ordinary deformation ring. So the weight's not fixed, so the weight's going to vary here. And somehow, oops, if you know enough R equals T theorems in higher weight, if you know that this maps an isomorphism when you specialize in enough weights, you can deduce that it was an isomorphism to begin with. However, if we specialize in weight 1, well, on the side of modular forms, we might not get a classical form. So we get over convergent, a priori, possibly non-classical form. Okay, so any sort of ordinary deformation of weight 1 classified by this deformation ring is going to correspond to an over-convergent eigenform, and of course you'd like to be able to show that it's classical, and as Payman explained to you today, this was done by Buzzard and Taylor. So they proved classicality of this form in, let me just say, most cases. Somehow they need the Frobenius eigenvalues to be distinct. So there's this, and well, I want to mention something else that's known in weight one. So actually, it's now known that any Artin representation. So let me just say here, odd Artin representation, it's mentioned too, is modular, and of course of weight 1. So this is due to Carré and Carré-Vantin-Berger. So Carré had a paper from a number of years ago that showed that this odd Artin conjecture followed from Serre's conjecture, and then he and Vantin-Berger proved it. But somehow this still leaves, there's some cases that are not covered. So if, I suppose now I go back to taking a p-adic representation, GL2 QP bar is odd and unramified at p, or let me just say finitely ramified at p. And then rho is expected to have finite image. And hence be an Artin representation, and hence be modular. So there's actually somehow, but this, so, well, it's expected, but this is, I guess, let me just say here, this is not known. Not known when Buzzard-Taylor doesn't apply. Pardon? Oh, yeah, sorry. I do, and I'll be working in that context. Finite, thank you. Finitely ramified at P, unramified almost everywhere. So the point is that there's still some odd odd representations of weight 1 that we still can't prove are modular. In fact, related to this is a conjecture of Boston. Sort of generalizing Fontaine-Maeser conjecture. So if K is a number field, S is a finite set of primes not containing any primes above P, and R is a complete local ring, R mod M, sort of a finite extension of FP, then any representation n-dimensional representation that's factored through the maximal extension and ramified everywhere away from S should have finite image. So that's this remark about these representations finitely ramified at P fall into Boston's conjecture. So significant state theorem at this point. So I'm just going to start with the residual representation. So I'm going to let rho bar from GQ to GL2FP bar be continuous, odd, irreducible. So now by Searle's conjecture, we know that it's modular. I'm going to assume that P is at least 3. what else? I'm going to let N be the Searle level of rho. And I'm going to let R min be the ring classifying deformations which are, well, they're going to be unramified at P. I better assume that rho bar is unramified at P. Apologies. I want to get a non-zero ring, so I want to only allow deformations that are unramified at P. I want them to be minimal. At all primes, I apologize for the notation X not equal to P. I want a determinant to be equal to the Teich-Muller lift of the determinant of rho bar. And let me just call that chi or something. and now I want some Taylor-Wiles type assumption. So normally I would have to assume that rho bar was modular, but I don't have to do that now. But I do want to assume that rho bar restricted to GQ theta P is irreducible. Then we have an isomorphism a sort of R equals T theorem where the Pekka algebra is acting on H1 of the modular curve X1 of N coefficients in the sheaf omega that Frank described in the last talk, push forward of the relative differentials of the universal elliptic curves, localized at the maximalized, so T is just a Pekka algebra sort of generated by the operators at good primes and diamond operators. So here in this, of course, this will be a faithful action. So look at the subring of the endomorphisms of this finite ZP mod. So here I'm really thinking of this as this is over ZP. So this module is a finite ZP module. And moreover, this space of H1 of omega localized at M is free of rank 1 over T. Okay, so that's somehow the end of the statement. So let me make some remarks. Let me say in words, this minimal condition, somehow this sort of appeared in the original work of Taylor-Wiles. It's somehow saying that, roughly, the minimal condition is that if I have some deformation, I look at the image of inertia at x, this would somehow be isomorphic to the image of inertia under rho bar. Now, this is not true in all cases, but this is roughly what we're trying to insist on. So basically, we're looking at lifts which are as minimally ramified as possible, given that rho bar might have some ramification. I mean, I can be more precise later if people want. So the existence of the map from R min to T, this is what Frank discussed in the last talk. So this was discussed, this uses sort of this local global compatibility that Frank discussed in the last talk. The point being that I need to know that we do get a deformation over the Hecke algebra just by constructed using congruences and multiplying by the half invariant, but you need to know that that's unramified at P. And that's what Frank told us how to prove last time. So again, this was also discussed last time, but let me just mention again, this space, this cohomology in degree 1, which might look a little unfamiliar, it's Pontryag and dual is H0 of omega, maybe minus the cusps. And this is just sort of the direct limit of all mod t to the n forms of weight 1. So this implies one thing, for example, that any deformation to characteristic 0, let me just say, which I can think of as being a ZP bar point of spec R min, is modular of weight 1. Okay, because the Hecke eigenvalues are going to somehow come from something in H0 that we know about. Already this is giving some extra cases of this. So what else do I want to say? So of course, again, as Frank discussed, this space need not be torsion free. So H1, X1n, omega may have torsion. So in particular, this module T, or this Hecke algebra, need not be flat over ZP. So our result is telling you that even sort of torsion minimal deformations of rho bar are all accounted for by this Hecke algebra T. So for example, we have the following corollary. So rho bar is in the theorem. So any deformation of rho bar, which is minimal, let me just say minimal everywhere, so that would in particular imply unramified at P, has finite image. The point being that the Galois representation defined over the Hecke algebra is constructed from it's sort of gluing together a bunch of finite image representations coming from weight 1 forms or mod p to the n weight 1 forms. So hence the universal minimal deformation even has finite image. So of course this is related, this proves the case of this conjecture of Boston that I mentioned earlier. Okay. Let me just make a remark. So in non-minimal cases, we should be able to prove using our methods not quite an R equals T theorem, but rather that R acts nearly faithfully on the appropriate space here. So nearly faithfully means that the annihilator of this module in R is a nilpotent ideal. So of course if we know that R is equal to T, then we know that R is actually acting faithfully. So again, this would be subject to some condition. Let me just say here, special primes. I mean, Steinberg. So, of course, if you're weight one, you don't expect, if you have a Galois representation that you expect to correspond to a weight one form, you don't expect it to be Steinberg anywhere, because that would force the image of the Galois representation to be infinite, but it's somehow hard to rule that out a priori. So, this would give applications to modularity. But it would sort of, we would lose information on the, we would lose the fact that the Heck algebra is also accounting for torsion deformations. So actually, there's some small print, so let me put a little star here, and it's not supposed to be a jewel or anything like that. It's supposed to be small print. So actually, this statement needs to be slightly modified in a certain case. So in the presence of vexing primes, so in the terminology of diamond, so these are primes x, such that x is equivalent to minus 1 mod p, and rho bar restricted to gx is irreducible. And these are kind of annoying because somehow just working at minimal level on the side of modular forms for these vexing primes doesn't guarantee that the deformations you get, the deformations of Heck algebra will be minimal at that prime. So we need to modify it a bit. So we need to replace H1, X1, and omega by H1, sort of X1M, omega tensor L, where M here is M is a divisor of N, it's just somehow the primes corresponding to the primes of adding ended are not vexing. And this L, this is a vector bundle that's somehow cutting out a minimal inertial type. At the vexing primes. So Diamond figured out how to deal with these vexing primes, and we follow we do an analog of how these are dealt with in the paper of Broy, Conrad, Diamond, and Taylor. So somehow the local system analog of this L appears in their paper. Okay, so how parallel situation. I'm going to take K over Q, an imaginary quadratic field. Let me just say here, so I don't want to be too precise here, but we can prove a theorem similar to the previous one, subject to a conjecture on the existence of Galois representations. Associated to integral cohomology classes in the cohomology of the associated locally symmetric spaces. So I don't want to introduce a whole load of notation and so forth, but let me just sort of say this sort of this space of weight one forms, this is over Q, and this here V over K, gets replaced by the first homology, let me just say here, Y1N, and let's just suppose I'm going to work in sort of trivial weight. So we look at just the Atal cohomology of these are the locally symmetric spaces associated to an imaginary quadratic field. Pardon? Just Betti cohomology, if you like. Did I say Atal cohomology? Sorry, Betti cohomology. And we have sort of a Hecke algebra acting here. And then the minimal deformation ring will sort of be, will classify sort of finite flat deformations. So here. So we're going to work at good levels, so P is not divide N. So we're going to look at finite flat deformations. P and sort of minimal everywhere else. And we get a similar statement, but we need to assume existence of a representation valued in this localized Hecke algebra. And of course, this is an integral Hecke algebra, and these spaces may well contain torsion, similar to the case of weight one forms. So this, of course, is quite it's a big conjecture, but there has been some related progress. So let me just remark here that so recent work of Harris that was announced at the previous workshop here in Toronto, Harris, let me get this in the line, Taylor Thorne, proves existence of a deformation when I invert P. So somehow, if their methods could be pushed to work on an integral level, then our modularity techniques are somehow will become valid, and we'd be able to then actually prove R equals T in modularity lifting terms over imaginary quadratic fields. Okay. So, but again, I have no idea how difficult or otherwise it is to extend their methods to an integral situation. Okay, so I want to now discuss this Taylor-Wiles defect that I mentioned at the beginning and sort of explain why there's some connection between weight one forms and sort of regular automorphic forms over a quadratic imaginary field. So that's going to come down to the Taylor-Wiles defect. So it's going to take an n-dimensional representation of the Galois group of Q over ZP bar. So I'm going to let this be a continuous representation. And this is this is going to be something that we'd like to prove as automorphic. Okay, so the Galois representations that we get from automorphic forms have the property that they're Durham. So let's start out by assuming that. So let's suppose that rho restricted to GQP is Durham, and let's suppose its Hodge-Tate weights are H1 less than or equal to H2 less than or equal to HN. And for simplicity, I'm just going to assume it's crystalline, but this is not necessary. A local deformation ring, so it's decorated with the P below to remind us that it's local, the CR to remind us the word crystalline, and H set of Hodge-Tate weights. So this is the local deformation ring of rho bar restricted to GQP. And let me just say here, classifying crystalline lift or crystalline deformations with Hodge-Tate weights just given by this tuple H, and I also want to fix the determinant, and determinant equal to the determinant of rho. Yes, thank you. So this is just local. Now I put this in inverted commas because crystalline doesn't make sense over an Artinian base. However, Mark Kissin was able to... one way I could have just defined this would be to take the unrestricted local deformation ring, take the Zariski closure of the points I'm interested in, and then you get some ring. And in fact, it turns out that after you take Zariski closure, you don't actually throw in any other points. So if you want, you can just define this thing by Zariski closure. So this was constructed by Kissin. What do I need about this thing? Well, I don't need for this talk. All I want to know is that the relative dimension over ZP of this ring, well, it's equal to this. So here P is the parabolic of GLN that stabilizes the Hodge filtration. And where do these numbers mean? So this one here corresponds to somehow deforming the Vedelin representation. So let's just imagine to work out what the dimension is, I can just take the completion at a closed point in a generic fiber, which is then a deformation ring of a characteristic zero crystalline representation. And if I want to understand this dimension, I need to understand the tangent space of that functor. And, well, you can somehow deform the Vedaline representation, and then you can deform the Hodge filtration. Somehow this is saying you can do these independently, I guess. And then this minus 1 is coming because we fixed the determinant. So in total we get the dimension of GLN mod P. Okay, so now, well, so we can see that this, the dimension is somehow only depending on the shape of the Hodge filtration. So this is going to be biggest when this P is a minimal parabolic. So P will be equal to a Borel. And that, when will that happen? Well, that would mean all the graded pieces are, of the Hodge filtration are just one-dimensional. So that's the same as saying that all Hodge state weights are distinct. As soon as we allow the multiplicities in the Hodge state weights, this P gets bigger and this deformation ring gets smaller. This is somehow saying that when we're looking at Galois representations of low weight, there's fewer of them. That's essentially the reason why the Taylor-Wiles method failed in that case. So now I'm going to define two integers. So I'm going to let delta P of rho simply just be the dimension of this ring. And I'm going to define delta infinity of rho to be the dimension over FP bar of H0. So I look at the prime at infinity, I get a group of order 2, and this acts on the adjoint the trace zero part of the adjoint representation of rho bar, and I look at the invariance in there. Okay, so this has dimension n squared minus 1, and this is a group of order 2. Okay, so this just depends on the number of plus 1 and minus 1 eigenvalues of complex conjugation. So now make the following definition. The Taylor-Wiles defect of rho is delta rho, which is delta infinity rho minus delta p of rho. And the point is that the Taylor-Wiles method sort of only works if this invariant is equal to zero. And in general, delta of rho is greater than or equal to zero. Okay, so you can somehow work out what's the minimal dimension of H0. Well, that's just going to correspond where the number of plus or minus one eigenvalues are as close as they possibly can be, so they're either equal or differ by one. And then you can work out somehow what's the largest dimension of this thing. That's just going to be the dimension of the flag variety where you modify the Borel, and you can show that you always get an equality like this. Inequality. Okay. Pardon? No, so this is just depending. So what was the question? No, so this is literally just, I mean, you just take a matrix that's like identity to the P minus identity to the Q, where P plus Q is equal to N, and then you look, just compute what the dimension of this is. So all the, you know, all the stuff that will appear here is gonna not be in the invariant. So basically you can see you want that, you want to make P and Q as close as possible as they are. I mean, I'm just saying you can work out explicitly what the smallest this can be and the biggest this can be, and you show that you have a... Yeah, sorry. Oh, that's okay. All right. So, of course, you can generalize it. One can generalize definition to somehow I can be over any number field. And, well, let me just put a reductive group G here. Okay, so K number field. G is a reductive group. Pardon. K is F, yeah. Okay, so let's do some examples. So let's suppose I have row from GQ to GL2 ZP bar, odd, and let's suppose it's coming from a modular form of weight K, so its Hodge-Tate weights are going to be equal to 0 and K minus 1, then delta of rho is equal to what? Well, what's happening at infinity? At infinity we have, I assume we're odd, so that means the complex, we've got plus minus 1, and then I'm looking at trace 0, so I'm looking at matrices of the form A minus A, B, C, and these two parts are not going to be invariants. The invariants are just one-dimensional. And then I have to subtract off the definition of the local deformation ring. Well, if the Hodge-Tate weights are distinct, then I'm looking at GL2 mod of Borel, which is like P1, so I get 1 minus 1, which is equal to 0, if K is bigger than or equal to 2. But if I allow K equal to 1, then this P becomes the whole group, and I get 1 minus 0, which is equal to 1. So if K is equal to 1. So we see the defect jumps there for weight 1 forms. So let's do a quadratic imaginary field. So I have rho. There's no odd, of course, there's no oddness condition here. But let's assume that for all V dividing P, rho restricted is decomposition group. All we need has distinct Hodge-Tate members. Then delta of rho is going to be equal to what? Well, now this group G infinity, because I'm over a complex field, so K here is imaginary quadratic, that's a trivial group, so I get just the dimension of add 0, and then I need to subtract off the dimension of the two local deformation rings, or one depending on how P splits. So let's just assume P splits into two primes. The calculation above shows us that we're just going to get a 1 and a 1 for each of those. So that will be equal to 1. So somehow on the Galois side, we see the same phenomenon for weight 1 forms as we do for regular things over an imaginary quadratic field. So let me just give a couple of other examples where the defect is 1. For, let's say, rho from GQ to GL3, QP bar, odd, and to distinct Hodge-Tate numbers. Rho GQ to GSP4, QP bar, odd, and Hodge-Tate numbers, AA, 0, 0 for some A positive. So this here, where A is 1, would include the case of abelian surfaces. And let me just give one more example. I mean, you can easily get examples where delta is higher by just increasing 3 here, or 4 here, or working over totally real fields. But let me just do the case of sort of even representations, just to see what we get. So if I take GQ to GL2 QP bar, even, and finitely ramified at P. So this is the sort of thing that should correspond to an algebraic mass form. So the Hodge-Tate weights would be 0 and 0. Then you kind of see that these things are quite bad from this perspective because their defect is 3. All right, so in the last few minutes, I want to just briefly describe some features of the Taylor-Wiles method. So in Taylor Wiles, we're trying to prove an R equals T theorem. And in general, T will be defined as a sort of faithful ring of endomorphisms of some module M, where M will be the space of, you know, some cohomology, some, you know, locally symmetric space or modular curve, or have some local system or some sheaf on that thing. And I don't want to be precise at all about the context here. so this is some here. This is some appropriate space. So Taylor Wiles sort of allows you to assume you have a tower. So this will be Rx, the one we start with, and you can sort of assume that you have a whole tower of things living over it. And each of these maps to Xi minus J is going to be Galois, with the Galois group, an abelian P group, so delta J. This is going to be Z mod P to the power Q for some Q that's sort of independent of everything. Yes, thank you. And so we'll have sort of modules MI at each stage. And sort of Taylor Wiles, so what do we want? We want the R act faithfully on M. That's the same as saying the map from R to T is an isomorphism. And Taylor and Wiles sort of reduce it to R infinity acts faithfully on M infinity, where M infinity is just the inverse limit of the MIs up the tower. And what's R infinity? Well, it's some sort of inverse limit of deformation rings, but concretely, it's just a power series ring where G is the sort of the dimension of the tangent space of R, the global deformation ring we're interested in. So this is calculated explicitly by some Selmer group, dimension of some Selmer group. Now, of course, note that M infinity is also a module over this completed group ring, so sort of the limit of the ZP delta J's. And this sort of, what's this? This is sort of Vp delta infinity, which is going to be another power series ring, Y1. And the number of variables I need is Q, where Q is this Q here. And where this Taylor-Wiles defect comes in is as follows. So we have a formula that Q minus G is equal to delta of rho. So if delta is equal to zero, see, it suffices to prove that the dimension of R infinity over M infinity over R infinity is G plus one. And if delta is equal to zero, this is somehow the same as being the dimension over lambda infinity of M infinity equal to Q plus one. And this is implied by M infinity being free over lambda infinity. And then this is implied by each mi being free over the finite level group ring Cp delta I. So somehow we've reduced what we want to a topological question. So now we just have a finite cover. So we sort of have xi over x, and we have a delta I acting here, and we get an action of delta I on the cohomology, and we want to know that that's free. And that was indeed a key step in the Taylor-Wiles proof. So Taylor-Wiles, now x is, you know, some modular curve. Q is just going to be a finite set of primes. And delta is going to be a p power quotient of z mod q cross. And then we have sort of a diagram of, so we have x1 of q, we have x0 of q, and then I'm going to have x delta of q to be the corresponding subcover here. So this is now a p group. And Taylor and Wiles proved, or maybe Deschalis, I forgot to look it up before. I think it's Deschalis, proved that h1 of x delta q Zp localized at m is free over O of delta. And that was the sort of key finite level input for that was sort of this statement. So if delta is equal to 1, then what do we want? Well, then the dimension of lambda infinity and r infinity. Now, lambda infinity is one dimension bigger, so we've got no hope of showing that each of these finite level things is free, because that would somehow imply that the space of modular forms of infinity would be too big. So what do we need? We need a condition on these finite level modules that guarantee that the inverse limit, that m infinity has sort of not free. We want it to be actually codimension 1 over lambda infinity, or better, will be projective dimension 1. Somehow for technical, I mean, somehow at the end we apply an Auslander-Buxbaum theorem exactly as Diamond did in his paper on the Taylor-Wiles method. And for that, you want to know about projective dimension. So we need a replacement for this freeness theorem, and so let me just finish by saying what that is. I think I started a couple of minutes late, so maybe I've got 2 minutes or 3 minutes or something. So definition, A a local ring, M is going to be a finite A module. We say M is balanced if the dimension of M mod, so we look at M mod the maximal ideal. So this is going to be a vector space over the residue field minus the dimension of tor 1, which way did tor go down here? I want this to be positive, or greater than or equal to 0. So I'm looking at the dimension of tor 0 minus tor 1. And really what we use about this is that if M is balanced, then there exists a presentation, A to the A goes to A to the A, goes to M, goes to zero. So it's looking something like a projective resolution, except on, we don't know that, of course, I'm not asserting that this first map's injective. And our analog of the Chalice theorem is the following. So proposition, the ZP delta module H1 X delta Q omega. So now this is a modular curve of ZP is balanced. Now localized at a non-Eisenstein maximal ideal, and that's important, is balanced. And then we're sort of, this is the key property, because using this, what we deduce at infinity is something like this. But we know that this M infinity has to be a torsion module, so let me call this phi. So I know that phi tensored over the fraction field of lambda is onto, and hence an isomorphism, and this implies, in fact, that phi is injective, and hence that the projective dimension of M infinity is equal to 1, which is exactly what we wanted to prove. And then, sort of going through this, we in fact then deduce that the original space we were interested in, was free of our original deformation ring. So I'll stop there. So if delta is 2, I think we can, for example, handle the case of parallel weight 1 Hilbert modular forms over a real quadratic field. But somehow you have to... I mean, the obvious thing would be to try and stick an extra term here. But the problem is that somehow presentations... I mean, if I have a presentation and I reduce mod m, it's still a presentation, but if I... tensoring is right exact, but that fails. So somehow you should take a more derived approach, so you have to somehow consider all degrees of cohomology. So you might try and use some sort of Hochschild-Serre spectral sequence or Poincaré duality spectral sequence, as in your completed cohomology papers, and you can try and do something there, but you run into problems that you need things to vanish in almost all degrees except one. And I think for real quadratic fields, you can make such an argument, but it's not... That argument sort of is not going to generalize to cubic fields, for example. So, I mean, we're working on it, but we don't.
But it's not quite as active as time?
No.
What do you need to work on the heat of movement?
Yeah. So somehow you're going to allow. You're going to allow non-minimal lift. So then the sort of local deformation rings at the primes away from P, you then have to understand what these local deformation rings look like. So one thing you might do is, let's say you might say, I'm just going to fix an inertial type. And so I'm only going to now, instead of minimal deformations, I'm going to consider deformations of a fixed minimal type, a fixed inertial type. That will give you some sort of quotient or tau of this ring. And for example, and then you need to cut out the same thing on the modular form side using some sheaf, then you would need to show something about this ring. So if this ring happened to be irreducible, you'd be in good shape. Or if its generic fiber was irreducible, you'd probably also be in good enough shape. So when I made the remark earlier that we can do stuff in the non-minimal case, it was just sort of that we did some sort of calculations that suggested that in many cases these things were irreducible. Another thing you might try and do is use base change. So in sort of well developed, in the case where delta is equal to zero, people are using solvable base change all the time to remove local difficulties. But the problem is that if delta is equal to 1 over q, and then you make an extension, it multiplies it by the degree of the extension. So you're fine if delta was originally 0, but now